Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, as usual, each month, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Craig Joseph. He is the Chief Medical Officer at Nordic Consulting Partners and also my regular appearance for News You Can Use. Craig, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure as always.
Today's episode is sponsored by Atlantic.net, the award-winning cloud hosting company trusted with securing critical data for over 25 years. Their industry-leading HIPAA-compliant cloud hosting solutions are backed by a fully audited 100% service level agreement and customer satisfaction guarantee. Get started today with your free trial at Atlantic.net. So, Craig, this month, as usual, we're now years into the pandemic. We continue to sort of focus on it. A little bit of news coming out of the CDC on mask and mask guidance. Any thoughts, and where does that fit into what you do day to day?
Yeah, well, the thoughts are, I'm glad they put out some guidance, and people have probably been doing a lot of the things that they're now telling us that we can do. So, if you're fully vaccinated, and just to go over definitions, fully vaccinated means, at least in the United States, you've received two. You're at least 2 weeks away from your final dose. And so if that was a single dose J&J, that's 2 weeks after that, or 2 weeks after your second of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. So the recommendations are that you can go outside and do lots of stuff if you're fully vaccinated. And if you're not, you should probably be wearing a mask or not doing some of those things. And I think the simple way of looking at it was, or at least is, if you're fully vaccinated, you're probably okay to be outside without a mask at no risk to you or others, as long as you're not in a large crowd. And I think that's good advice. That's the advice that I've been following, even quite frankly, before I was vaccinated.
Oh, tish. You mean you've not been following to the letter of the guidelines?
You know, there's this thing called science, and I've been reading some of the articles for the last year, and the risk was so infinitesimally small, if not non-existent, when you're just walking outside. And so, yeah, if I'm walking outside on the sidewalk in a suburban area where there's not a ton of people, yeah, I don't think I needed to wear a mask long before I got vaccinated. And if I saw some people coming towards me, either they or I would move a little onto the grass, or so we're at least 6 or 10 feet away from one another. And I think that's been fine. So it's now officially fine if you're fully vaccinated, according to the CDC, and that's great. We definitely want the government to start to paint a picture of the benefits of vaccination, I think. And so anything that the government does to say, like, hey, here's some of the good things that can happen when we get to enough of the population to be fully vaccinated, anything to, you know, push people in the right direction, I think is a good thing. So I applaud them and want more. I totally understand that they're a scientific conservative organization, and that's fine.
I think that's the point, isn't it? That they're conservative because they don't want to sort of open things up appropriately. So it's interesting you mentioned the science and the papers. I actually just reached over 500 papers in my stash of reading material for the last year of all of the things that I had processed, much beyond anything I'm pretty sure I read in my entire medical school career.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The Master of Public Health degree was never something that I was even remotely interested in. And now, I think if I won the lottery and didn't have to work anymore, I might go get one of those MPHs.
Yeah. I've even seen some online courses to give people a sort of foundation, and I have that in my stack of watching material that I get to less frequently than I do for the reading material. So, all right. So I agree. I mean, I think opening things up to where they pretty much are. And, you know, that's good news. Some commentary about the complications. I think we've seen a little bit of headline grabbing rare neurological condition, in this case, acute transverse myelitis, which is inflammation of the spinal cord, is occurring in a number of cases, but not that many. I think the number I saw was 43, and that's in the total of the countries covered. So we're talking millions. So I think the incidence was less than 1 in 2 million or so. So not frequent, not to be discounted. There are other more pressing problems around long COVID.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And everything we do has risk, right? Walking outside our front door has risk. Taking a vaccine for the flu has risk. And so, you know, I think what you have to do is judge what is the risk of doing that thing versus the risk of not, right? And so certainly we want to make people aware, similar to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, there was a risk that we were not aware of, found out about it. It's still highly unlikely. And I think moving forward is most definitely the right thing to do. So transverse myelitis, Guillain-Barré, there are lots of diseases that can be associated with vaccination, but the incredible benefits that come with it from a societal standpoint are clearly worth it. And yeah, it's a risk to get in your car, to go on the airplane, but I still do those things.
And also, to be clear, not just from a society benefit, but also from an individual benefit. Getting that vaccine gives you opportunities to do things that otherwise would be a little bit harder. I have to give you credit. I think you are the origin story, at least for me, for the explanation I use all the time, which is the seatbelt analogy that you talk about, that you used to use with your parents, explaining that you can wear a seatbelt, but that doesn't prevent you from having a car crash and dying in that car crash. It's all about risk. So absolutely. In the I don't know what to describe this news, but apparently if you get vaccinated in a specific area in Florida, there's a private school there that won't employ you, any teachers or staff, if you've been vaccinated. Thoughts?
Well, I have many thoughts, a few of which I will verbalize to you now. But this is a group, the founders of this school. I was not aware of their existence until I started reading about them a couple of days ago. You know, they've been against a lot of things that I think the scientific community has shown to be effective and safe. And vaccines are one of those things. And so they hold theories, at least the people that run that school, that somehow magically bad things happen when you get vaccinated. I think for pretty much every vaccination, but certainly for the COVID vaccine. And so they have put out a decree that for teachers at their school, they are concerned for the safety of their children and hence won't allow their teachers to be vaccinated because they hold the belief. And I say it's a belief because there's no science to in any way support this, that adults who are vaccinated for COVID are somehow a healthcare danger to children. Again, it's a great idea.
I'm sorry, I cannot hold my tongue for a second longer. It is it's just shocking to me that level of misunderstanding at best, and that's being generous, of science. Proven science that continues to be perpetuated, that seems in large part, and to be clear, the anti-vaccine movement predates Andrew Wakefield and his debacle of the 12 children that he published a study that was ultimately withdrawn. But that seems to be a sort of inflection or seminal moment. And, you know, at this point, just a quick shout out to Brian Deer, who was the author of the excellent book, The Doctor Who Fooled the World. He was the one that originally broke that story. Much to my shame, this all is centered at the Royal Free Hospital School of Medicine, which is where I trained. And I'm very sad that we're associated with that. And some of the people that I know got sucked into all of this inadvertently. I'm not so sure any of it was entirely deliberate. I think there was a lot of whirlwind around this. But One of the things that really challenges my thinking around this is, how is it that the United States of America welcomes Andrew Wakefield, brackets, not a doctor, he was struck off the medical register for his disservice, fraud, and changing of results proven. How is it that he's allowed to come to the United States and live and work here?
I have no idea. You know, people are free to have their own opinions, right? And when they have opinions about things, this is where it gets awkward for me, right? When they have opinions, you know, I have an opinion that I like a particular sports team. That is clearly an opinion, and there's no fact around that my sports team is the best sports team that there is. I acknowledge that other people like other sports teams, and that those are just opinions. However, when folks talk about their opinions as if they were facts, and discounting what we know about how the world works and discounting the scientific process and how experiments work, you know, then it's a danger. And so you can come, you can say whatever you want. And I think one of the major problems that we have in the U.S., of many problems that we're having in the U.S., is the inability to critically reason among a large proportion of our population. And so, you know, when you hear someone on TV say something and it doesn't agree with, you know, tenets that you've been taught for a long time and that you can, you know, prove empirically, you should question that. And I think some people don't. And apparently a lot of the parents at that school don't. That's all that I could come up with because.
Well, I appreciate that. And I think, you know, reasonable analogy, it's just a big struggle for me because I know how hard it is as an immigrant myself to get into this country and prove that, you know, I have value to bring and, you know, appropriate measures and so forth. I know that immigration is an emotional subject, but I'm an immigrant and therefore, you know, I'm grateful to be here. But I struggle with that. Anyway, for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Today, I'm talking to Dr. Craig Joseph, Chief Medical Officer at Nordic Consulting Partners. We're in our News You Can Use segment. Just a reminder on today's sponsor, and you can get started with your free trial at Atlantic.net, the simple solution for your HIPAA compliance and cloud hosting needs. We were just talking about vaccines and the debacle of anti-vaccines. And, you know, the challenge that we've seen in terms of adoption was sort of, we seem to be plateauing a little bit in the United States with COVID-19. What I'm hearing almost universally, and in fact, my email, I think I probably got 16 invitations to go register for a vaccine. And I am pretty sure I did not register at 16 different sites. It seemed like something got stuck somewhere, but an indication that supply now exceeds the demand. I'm hoping that perhaps the United States might take the responsible and world-leading position and start to allow for and actually promote the distribution of that on a more international basis to countries that are in desperate need of it, India being a case in point.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you, and my understanding is that we are sending some vaccine that is not yet approved, may not be approved in the U.S., the AstraZeneca vaccine, but is used in Canada and all throughout Europe. Sending that to Canada, to Mexico, and also sending a lot of raw materials that are used to produce immunizations to India to help. I think one thing that a lot of folks don't think about, certainly we have a moral and ethical calling to help our fellow man, but it's in our best interest here in the United States to try to eradicate this virus as quickly as we can. And the longer that takes, the more we are at risk from variants, right? So this is a virus that quickly mutates, and most of those changes are bad for the virus in terms of transmission or how serious it is. But every now and then, something changes and it makes it a little easier for it to get into the human and to do its damage. And the more that virus has time to mutate, all it takes is one airplane trip away, all of a sudden, many of us might lose the protection that we have. It might be that a certain vaccine doesn't work as well, whatever. And so there's, besides the moral and ethical, which should really be the only reason we need to think about. But if you don't have that, think about those two things, it's really for our own self-interest that we need to help all these other countries to get this pandemic under control.
100%. I think, you know, this is an international problem. It will never be solved in a single country. We owe a duty to our fellow humans around the world, and especially now, more than ever, we have an opportunity. And I'm glad to hear that we are, but the more we can do, I think, the better. Before we get into the next topic, I just want to give a quick shout out to the LexisNexis Risk Group. If you're interested, go check out their Times Like These video, which I have to say, truly outstanding. I have so many questions about this, not least of all, who was the individual that had this phenomenal recording studio, which I envy, you know, as a podcaster of occasional activity with, you know, full-on soundproofing, and the talent. Wow, amazing. Just, have you seen it?
I have seen it, and, I, for one, always knew that the LexisNexis Risk Group was full of very talented singers and musicians. I mean, I always put, whenever I think LexisNexis Risk Group, Nick, I think of musical talent.
Talented musicians with an incredible array of instruments, absolutely.
They don't know anything about consulting or risk, let's be clear.
Right.
But their musicianship is par none.
Absolutely. Fantastic. So thinking about digital health, one of the articles that ran across over the last couple of weeks was the inequity in digital access. We're talking, that's obviously one of my areas of focus. I know you have a passion for it. We see digital health as an augmenter of the service. It can help solve problems. It's not an answer in itself, but it really has the potential. But the point that was made in this is we have this massive disparity in access, both in terms of technology, not just internet access, but also in PCs and devices. Not everybody has a smartphone, and certainly not everybody has a bigger device to be able to access. We've seen Google, they have their Project Loon that is trying to launch into low Earth orbit, provide access. In fact, I got closer to that than I would have expected through a friend who moved into a remote area. That was their only choice. Shockingly, that's $100 a month, and there's, you know, some equipment costs. I don't think that's going to solve it. How do we fix this? What is it that we need to do to help reconcile this access problem?
Well, you've pointed out, you know, a multiple of issues, you know, the first being infrastructure, right? So do you have access to the bandwidth on the internet that you need in order to do a telehealth visit, or in order to have an EKG that you might do at your house get sent with the detail and quality it needs to go to your doctor to have them review it? And so that's, you know, step one. And step two is, if you do you know how to use it? That's an ongoing problem, you know. Telephone. So just to kind of switch the conversation just a tad, today, because of the pandemic, most insurance companies and the federal government will pay for telephone consults. And so what that means is, if you're talking to your doctor on the phone, in the before times, that would never be something that the doctor could bill the payer for. But now they can, if it's a conversation of significant length, not just to, you know, tell you something very quickly. And so even a telephone conversation, which I can't see you, I can't send you any information, that's being reimbursed. And now the government's talking about, should that continue to be? I think it's related to your question. There are folks who don't have a smartphone. There are folks who don't have a computer in their house. And their only way of getting information to or from their doctor is either by going in to see them or via the phone. And I think until we get, and now I'll finally answer your question, until we get to a point where this technology is as ubiquitous and easy to use as the telephone, we're going to run into to problems. And the problems are not on just the patient side, let's be clear. I've had some telehealth visits where my doctor couldn't get it to work, and we reverted to telephone. So, and again, I'm not questioning the doctor's ability to understand the technology nor to have the infrastructure in place. It just didn't work. It's still a young technology, and there are just going to be times where that guy, I don't know what happened, but I've only got this 10-minute slot, so we're just going to move to the telephone only. And that's happening to me, so I know it's happening to others.
So it's interesting you bring that up. I mean, a little bit shocking that they're trying to put that particular genie back in the bottle and say, oh, no, now it no longer COVID. This doesn't apply anymore, whereas it did before or during. It's, for me, a struggle. I'm not saying it's... They're not going to try very hard. There's probably somebody somewhere that's got some vested interest in this genie getting back in. But, you know, the telephone is a phenomenal resource to interact. And some people, that's their level of comfort. It used to be that the diagram showed, you know, older generation silver tsunami were much, they preferred that. But that's not actually true. They just didn't have access and weren't as comfortable. And I thought where you were going to go was literacy, not just with health, but, you know, with technology. I don't think it's so much of that. It's more about access, because I saw it with my own mother. As soon as she had access, and in fact, speech was a big enabler for her. When Siri showed up, she stopped calling me and texting me with 17 different messages on how to turn off the mute button on her iPhone. It took that long when we were texting together. Whereas she could just say, mute my phone, Siri, and it worked. So I just think that's terrible. We can't allow for this. You have got to stop this, Craig.
Yeah, I will, when we stop this recording, I will take care of this. Are there any other inequities you would like me to fix? Any other disease processes you want me? I can take care of the pandemic as well, if you'd like that.
I think we're not going to call on too much from you beyond that. If you could just fix that, I think that would be
all right.
Perfect for us.
I'm on it.
Excellent. So a couple of minutes left, thinking about privacy and the allocation of all of this information that's now in the digital domain. Do you think we're doing a good job around that securing and cybersecurity of information?
Well, it comes to a point where does it really matter? And I think we're about to hit. I'm not answering any of your questions today, Dr. Nick. I apologize. We're at the point where patients are going to be very easy. It's going to be very easy for patients to take their private medical information out of some very safe spots, like the electronic health record or the patient portal, and move it to a third party company. And with their permission, of course. Mm. And now once that happens, I think we're going to see a lot of that information kind of get out or move around in ways that people didn't anticipate. Either they didn't anticipate because they didn't read the agreement that they signed, or that the people that wrote the agreement didn't abide by it.
Or the fact that it was 17 pages and they couldn't read it because it was wrong and they had to get through.
But usually somewhere in there, it says, you give us permission to share this information with X for this reason. And so you know, to answer your question, are we doing a good job of keeping patient private information safe? Absolutely, because there's a lot of laws and a lot of incentives to do so. However, once that information kind of escapes out legally with your permission, it's out there. And it's going to be hard to get that genie back in. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I just think
this is another genie you've got to stop. So I think this is the subject of a future conversation. But unfortunately, as we do each week, we've run out of time. So I'd just like to thank our sponsor today, Atlantic.net. Keeping your focus on the patient is essential, and having the wrong cloud service plan can be costly. Start with your free trial of HIPAA compliance cloud hosting today at Atlantic.net. And from you, Craig, thanks for joining me as you do every month. It's always a pleasure. And I'm glad that you're taking on the tough problems in healthcare to help us fix them and stop them from putting that genie back in the bottle. So thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.